Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson. This week we will be talking about affordable housing for all and an in-studio interview with our special guest, Ms. Kimberly J. Lewis. Also in our Voices from the Ether section of the program, we will have a live musical performance by Mr. Jack Rivera and Mr. Steve Garza. But first, I'd like to update the prison hunger strike at Pelican Bay State Prison. The 20-day prison strike that began July the 1st and ended July the 20th and resumed Monday, September the 26th, 2011, to protest the conditions of the prisoners in the security housing unit, also known as the SHU. This is day 15 of the strike. Here's what's happening. As the California prison strike entered its second week, supporters outside organized a press conference to stand in support of the 12,000 prisoners who are taking part. The press conference was organized by the California Prison Hunger Strike Action Network at West Hollywood City Hall. We will keep you updated every week on this show. If you would like to call in to the Qumran Report during the show, the number is 800-893-9562. We have with us in the studio Ms. Kimberly J. Lewis. She is the founder of G. Kim Media. She has over 25 years combined experience within business, technical, and entertainment professionals. Kimberly is also a very passionate humanitarian who dedicates her spare time to the homeless community throughout Los Angeles. She has also worked closely with the organization PATH, People Assisting the Homeless. Kimberly, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us a little about your background and how you got involved with working with the homeless.
I actually got involved with working with the homeless in the homeless community, actually in the community as a whole, when I was 13. I was a police explorer with Compton PD, and that exposed me to working in the community as a whole, whether it was with convalescent homes, cleaning up the community, things of that sort. And during that time is when I noticed things going on and people living on the street, and that was very disturbing to me.
Okay, well, what do you think that some of the things that the community can do to assist the homeless?
One of the things that I feel that can be done is for everyone to stop just walking by and shaking their heads and actually do something about it, such as really getting involved with your community, your city organizers, things of that sort. Things can change. I mean, so many things are in place to manage homelessness, but we don't need to manage it, because when you use that word manage, that means that you're planning for it to be around for a while, and it can actually be solved. So people just have to push for things, just like we pushed to get Obama in office. We can push to get these things changed too. So I just think really coming together and working as a team and actually caring would make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. We were talking a little earlier about some of the reasons that homeless individuals don't want to deal with missions and shelters and things like that. You was telling about the young lady who had a pet or something like that that she was attached to.
A pet, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, because a lot of the majority of the facilities are not equipped to house animals. Because if you notice, a lot of facilities aren't equipped to house families either. They have to go to special facilities if you have children. So it's either, like at PATH, it's like men on one floor, women on another floor. If you have a child, they have emergency housing to get you off the street for the night, but then they're feverishly trying to find you a spot at a facility that can handle, that is equipped for family units, is what they call it, to get you there. But definitely, it's very far and few in between for them to house animals. And I think that kind of needs to change, because people have to understand. You know, I had a lady that made a comment to me the other day who's not homeless, and she says, well, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, I would think that I'd rather give up my dog and get off the street rather than to, you know, be on the street. And I said, well, that's because you're thinking in the frame of mind that you're thinking. I was like, but when you're on the street and that's pretty much your only friend, one that doesn't judge you, one that keeps you company, one that's wagging its tail no matter what, I mean, it's a little different. So I do think that there should be some kind of provisions made for people that have animals, because it's not that easy to detach from them.
Mm-hmm. Now, do PATH have any special programs in relationship to dealing with families that find themselves homeless?
They, like I said, they'll take them in, but they will, you'll have to be moved to another, like a sister facility that's equipped for families, because they don't have the, their facility isn't equipped to deal with children and things of that sort. It's just single women, single men.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've worked a long time and you've seen a lot of things down here in the Skid Row area. What do you see as the main reason that so many people end up homeless, especially families, but generally your perspective on it?
Honestly, my perspective, I mean, I've worked with so many different agencies from all these years. And honestly, I just think a lack of being prepared for life, honestly, mm-hmm. because that was another thing. I was speaking with another girl who wants to start a nonprofit to help young girls. I really think it shouldn't just be for young girls. I think it should just be for youngsters, period. And I think it should start about the eighth grade. Because when you teach these life skills, not the life skills you hear about at these facilities, but I mean life skills like, you know, how to cope with depression, how to cope with, you know, people, how to deal with people, how to basically love yourself and have that self-esteem so it's not easily broken down and equipped for adversities. You know, mm-hmm. things are going to happen. Everything's not going to go the way you want it to go. You're not always going to get a good grade. You're not always going to have all of these friends, and everybody's not always going to like you. You know, in our society, it's like everything is built around that. So when you face, let's say someone has been doing well all this time, and then finally, maybe for whatever reason, they get hooked on alcohol or drugs or whatever, and they lose everything, and then the guilt comes in, then the anger, then that turns into depression, mm-hmm. then without treatment that turns into bipolarism, and then sometimes without that treatment they go on to schizophrenia. So it's just so many different things. But honestly, I would put it back to the beginning. because you teach all these other things in school, but except for how to be a human being. But we can name when the war happened in 18 whatever, but you can't, you know, it's like a manual. You need to really equip our children so that they can be bully proof and things of that sort. But it doesn't happen till it's too late.
Now, also, let me ask you this, and we'll get into it a little deeper when we start talking about the social networks and things. How much do you think the fact that we moved into the internet, the high tech, do you think that has a lot to do with putting people out of jobs? Is the fact that we moved into the internet world, the world of the internet, superhighway, as they say?
You know, that could be yes and no. I would probably say no, because honestly, that's opened up more opportunity for people to become entrepreneurs and be inventive and do things that they may have always wanted to do. Even if, like, a radio show, internet radio show, you can do your own show and for free on certain things. So honestly, I think the problem is just on capitalism as a whole, because these companies get so greedy, and you know, they're trying to save all of their money or as much money as they can, then they start outsourcing. So when you outsource, like, customer service centers to India and things of that sort, that takes away from jobs here. Just like, you know, because we're the California, the Sioux capital of the world, you know, everybody wants to sue for this, sue for that. So that scared a lot of companies into not hiring kids. So they only hire adults. So what happens, like, when I was a kid, I had a job at 13. I was getting a check. So, you know, it's hard to find companies that will hire teenagers. Remember, we used to go and get a work permit from your office at school, and you could go work. But it's really hard to find that now. So you take a lot of responsibility learning away from the kids. And then, two, you take a lot of the jobs away from us when you start outsourcing to different other cultures. You know, we need to keep that here, and we need to bring it back.
Okay, Kimberly, I would like to talk to you a little about G-Keem Media. You train business owners and individuals on how to simplify and maximize the social media presence on the internet. Let's talk about some of the services that you offer. First one, social media marketing planning. What is that?
You know, everything is social media now. Facebook, Twitter, not MySpace so much anymore. They're kind of like disappearing. But we teach businesses how to use the internet to create a presence and to generate interactivity with potential customers and current customers.
Oh, okay. And then how about social media management?
I go in and I teach them how to manage their media, meaning there's a strategy that you want to create depending on what kind of business you have and what your goals are. So we'll teach them how to generate, let's say, tweets. They can go in and 'cause it depends on the company. Some companies have a team. I've worked with companies that actually have 10 to 20 people that they have working on their social media, and then I've worked with companies that only had two or three. And definitely for those smaller companies, I recommend, you know, setting things up in advance, because you can't really afford to have somebody just on the internet all day while they're at work. You need to utilize them somewhere else. So, you know, unless it's something breaking news or something that you need to get out, I teach them how to basically schedule tweets and things in advance. And you can go in and do that up for a week, a month, 6 months, a year. It's up to you, however much time you have to do the data entry.
Now, this is what's interesting to me, the internet radio podcasting workshops. What do that entail?
I teach people how to go on and create their own show, introduce them to all of the different websites that are out there where they can do it for free, teach them about using the equipment that they choose to get. If they don't have a lot of equipment, you can, as long as you have a mic and the and your computer, you can still do it. So some people get fancy, some people, you just want to start out small. And then we talk about little marketing skills, you know, depending upon I always say it's kind of cool to start your show first. And kind of like I have a radio show, and I started mine first because I wanted to prove a point. Mm-hmm. So once I got X amount of followers and downloads and things of that sort, then you take that to potential sponsors. You know, maybe they want to buy ad spot. And they usually do if you can show that you have enough, mm-hmm. you know, people downloading and listening all the time. Mm-hmm. That kind of changed a little bit once the recession hit. I think everyone was pulling back on advertising, both on mainstream and internet radio. But that's pretty much what goes on in that class. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Jeremy might have a question or something for you since you're dealing with the internet radio, like Skid Row Studios. You have a question?
For me, as someone who's producing a lot of different shows, one of the things that's always on my mind is understanding how to understand the target demographics and who's listening and how often are people coming back and definitely curious if you've explored those types of things to really find out who's listening and what they like, what they don't like, and those are the things that are always on my mind.
I always engage, you know, my audience, so we're always including them throughout the show and saying if you have an opinion or if you have any topics you want us to discuss, to invite them to email us. And a lot of them do. A lot of them do email us, so they give us their ideas. They'll say, oh, that was a good topic. This was my experience about that. So I just really engage them. Definitely social media. Twitter is a really, really good tool for that. And two, if you think you have a good rapport with your audience, you can use like SurveyMonkey or PollDaddy, things of that sort, and create a poll for whatever you want to ask them. And then tweet that little, you know, turn it into a tiny URL and tweet that out and get, you know, encourage people to answer that. And then you can get some of your questions answered. I know for a fact that 90% of our listeners are men. And the other 10% are women. So on our show. Mm-hmm. So it just really depends. But see, I've been doing that show for almost 4 years.
Yeah, can you give us some basic information about your show? The name of the show, how do
name
we pull it up?
The name of the show is Lipstick Radio. It's lipstickradio.net. The show, it's kind of random. It's about, we interview people, we talk about different topics. Usually, it's a lot of relationships and the men-women issue. It's kind of comical, it's funny. But again, we touch on sometimes the serious stuff. We'll talk about statutory rape issues, child support issues. But for the most part, it's just a lot of fun and just shock jock, just to make you laugh and be like, oh my God, did she really say that?
Okay, a couple more questions. What about your social media workshop? What do that entail?
The social media workshop I enjoy doing the most because that's the least amount of work for me. Because I teach, people don't realize social media it's a lot of work. And depending on what you're trying to get out of it. So in the workshops I teach, I encourage the companies that participate to send the people that are actually going to be doing it. Because not everybody's computer literate, not everybody's going to understand all these different terminologies, hashtags, all that, mm-hmm. you know, tiny URLs, all that stuff. So I encourage them to send the people that are actually going to be doing it for them to the workshop. Because if you're not familiar with it, trying to explain what I'm telling you, it's mm-hmm. not going to be easy to do. So I just basically give them tips and we go through different websites, I'm a big fan of trying to maximize the free stuff. You know, why go pay for stuff and you can get something that works just as well for free? Now, there are some things that used to be free that they're charging for now, but like Hootsuite, I love Hootsuite. It's still free. But if you want to add what they call a team member, where like if I want to add you on to manage the things that I've set up, it's like $5.99 a month. So it's not that bad. But so that's pretty much what I do in there. Just give them the rundown because they're already technically inclined. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to, you know, start from the basics and say, okay, this is a mouse. This is a desktop. I pretty much can just go in and say, okay, this is what you do. Mm-hmm. We talk about strategies, how to not tweet more than four things out per day. You don't want to over, you know, inundate people. And also how not to advertise to people all the time, but also give them things, whether it's information, whether you're giving away things, contests. Because the social media is made to interact with people. Mm-hmm. We're already being sold so much, you know, with radio. We listen to ads, TV, billboards, magazines. So you really want this to be a place where, yeah, I can stick in some advertisements here and there, but you want to make it fun for them. So you want to find a way to interact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one last question. What is the best way for an organization or business to use a Facebook and Twitter?
You know, that depends on the organization because everyone's going to use it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And depending on the type of business you have, some businesses may not want to be on Twitter. Some people may not want to use certain things. Not every platform is for every business.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely I've noticed that Facebook has a different type of audience than Twitter. Facebook, if you do what you do on Twitter, like Twitter, you can tweet out, oh my gosh, this is the longest line, whatever. I don't know why people do that. I don't do that, but they do that. But on Twitter, I pretty much will tweet out news blasts, things that happened, just had like breaking news. If I find any cool articles, cool polls, whatever, you know, it's just different information. People are more open to that. Where Facebook, it's kind of like they just want, okay, you can give me some information here and there. You can tweet about what you're doing here and there, but that's pretty much it. Because if you over-engage them on Facebook, they will stop following you or mm-hmm. unlike you or, you know, depending on if you're operating as a page or yourself, your personal self. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Thank you, Kimberly. Kimberly, for those who want to get in touch with you, what is your contact information?
You can go to jenkimmedia.com and that's JenKimMedia.com and our phone number there is 818-971-9220.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one quick question.
Yeah.
How did you develop the name Jen Kim Media?
It's my name backwards. Because Jean is my middle name.
Okay.
So I was trying to find a way to like my middle name because for years I didn't.
Oh, beautiful.
Still
that's
don't.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you very much, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we enjoyed the information, all of that information. Okay. Next, we will move to our Voices to the Community section. On Saturday, October the 1st, 2011, Drama Stage Qumran, in conjunction with the Peace Center on the campus of USC, had a chance to present 80,000 nails to Habitat for Humanity to be used for building affordable housing for low-income community members. The presentation was made in Southgate at a foreclosure house that Habitat for Humanity purchased to fix up for low-income community members. We assisted with the painting. Tonight, in our Voices from the Community portion of the show, you will hear two interviews from that day. The first interview is from the family that would be living in the house, and the second interview from the foreman for Habitat for Humanity.
Okay, it's a Saturday, and we're here on Liberty Street in Southgate at a site for Habitat for Humanity with the two proud new owners of this rehab that Habitat for Humanity here in L.A. is refurbishing. There's the mother, Sandra, and her son, Gio, and I'm going to have them explain the process of how they arrived at this point to be proud owners of this property and refurbishing it today. So who would like to go ahead and start off? Okay, Sandra, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Sandra de la Garza, and this is my first house. You know, I like for Habitat because Habitat ayuda a todas las personas que necesitan para bajos recursos y por agarrar su casa. ellos se esfuerzan también para que nosotros podamos estar bien. Y yo agarré esta propiedad porque uno de mis hermanos me dijo, oye, hay un lugar que puedes ir a aplicar, que es Habitat. Entonces fui, hice procesos de Habitat y pues gracias a Dios me calificaron y ahora ya tengo mi casa, voy a tener mi casa y voy a estar happy por eso.
Okay. Gio?
All right. So basically just
su nombre.
Gio, my name is Gio Velasquez. Well, basically, we're happy that we got this program, Habitat, and she actually knew about this program because of her brother. Her brother actually mentioned this program, and she went ahead and tried out for this program and signed up for it. She actually qualified. She says she's really grateful for it, and
yeah. How long did it take? How long was the process?
Almost 1 year.
Almost a year.
Yes,
wow, that was pretty quick.
Yeah.
Pretty quick. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And are you in high school now, or Gio?
No, actually, I'm out.
You're out. Okay. Okay. College or?
Yes.
Okay. In the Southgate area, or where are you attending?
Long Beach.
Long Beach. What's your major?
City College?
No.
You're still of a major.
Oh, yeah,
okay. 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 So besides helping to fix the house up, what are your other plans for your new home? Do you have any? Do you any kind of special kind of garden you plan on growing here, or?
Mis planes son vivir en ella bien, estar feliz and I'm happy and all that. So eso sería mi plan, no algo para trabajar aquí o algo, no.
What?
Yeah, her new plans is basically just, you know, living happy in this house. Not really. Well, yeah, she'll put some stuff in it, make it look neat, but not to like work so hard on it. I mean, you know, just keep it simple.
So before all this happened, where were you living before? What was your living situation like? Or is still like?
En la situación de la donde estoy yo ahorita, donde estamos, es porque está muy pequeño y tengo que estar pagando la renta. Entonces, al agarrar una propiedad ya es tuya y ya no es necesario pagar rentas en otro lado.
Yeah, basically just, I mean, the other place is just too small and she has to pay the rent pretty high and stuff, mm-hmm. You know, and she's just tired of that. And I mean, she pretty much, it's a better idea having the property, owning a property than, I mean, you know, having your own house than paying for rent on an apartment.
So through Habitat for Humanity, the rent, and it's all completely paid for. You don't have to pay any taxes every year on the property. How is that?
No, porque el banco ya lo tiene, ya lo va a. Porque estoy en el programa del banco con Habitat. Entonces, el banco ya tiene ya todo incluido con el pago de la casa y seguridad y todo.
Well, basically the bank, which is, how would you say, like, it's basically covering for now the Habitat stuff.
Uh-huh,
and all that, so.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I'd like to thank you both very much for this opportunity, and hopefully others can hear this and see that there is some hope too.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much.
All right, Voices from the Community. I'm here with Rhett. Did I get that right?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
From Habitat for Humanity, and he's, I guess, the lead foreman here.
That's right.
Okay. And I'm going to have him just kind of take over this conversation and talk a little bit about his involvement with Habitat for Humanity and what he does. So go ahead, Rhett.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, today we're in Southgate, Los Angeles, working on a four-bedroom home and as part of Habitat for Humanity Greater LA. Our mission is to eliminate substandard housing here in the United States and around the world. In doing that, we use a lot of volunteers in that process. So I think a big portion of helping to eliminate substandard housing is to actually engage the community and really get people out there, knowing their neighbors, really helping out and lending a hand whenever they can. And so I started with Habitat for Humanity a year and a half ago. I was a full-time volunteer for a year through the AmeriCorps program, which is funded by the federal government in Ventura, California, and just loved it. The feelings I got through giving back and helping people that did need a hand was incredible. And so homelessness is a problem that extends far beyond our communities. It's worldwide, but as well, it's not something that's just worldwide. It is something that is in every community. And so you don't have to travel to Africa to go help out. You can do it on your block. You can do it on your street. Talk to your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Find out about those people around you that need help, because it is a community-driven effort.
Okay, great. So have you always wanted to be a carpenter or a builder, or is this your life's path? Or
it is, yes. At heart, I'm a free spirit. I'm a traveler, and I grew up with a father that was a builder, and so he built every house that we ever lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that is much like, I think, music. It's something that is a communication that transcends a lot of languages. Mm-hmm. People always need shelter, regardless of where you are. And so I'd like to be able to prepare myself for being able to travel the world. And I love interacting with people, and especially doing it with volunteers and helping for a cause larger than just yourself. It's a great way to be able to impart skills to someone else and have it be an educational experience and have it be something that is very, very rich. At the end of the day, I feel so good when I go home, not because of having completed another necessary construction task, but mm-hmm. for having taught someone how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy of, you know, give a man a fish and feed him for a day and teach a man to fish and feed him for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
When people leave here on the site, they know a little bit more about how their house works and about how to build shelter. And you can build shelter out of just about anything as long as you have those basic skills.
Mm-hmm. Has Habitat for Humanity taken you to any other places besides Southern California? Have you worked in any other locations yet?
I haven't worked with Habitat in any other locations.
Uh-huh.
I came to Habitat as a way to be able to get those initial building skills that
okay.
I was looking for.
Okay.
I've done an extensive amount of traveling in Central America and Mexico, and now Habitat's a part of my life.
Right.
Every place I go, I'll always be looking for Habitat affiliates.
Okay. So your feelings, your opinions, what do you think about the homeless condition here in the greater Los Angeles area from what you've seen?
I live in Venice Beach, and I've noticed an increase definitely in the homeless population. And it concerns me for sure. I think it is something that's on the rise. With that being said, I think it is an opportunity for people to evaluate what's important to them on a community level. Where I live, I actually live as part of a larger intentional community, and then so we're 10 people that live in a home, which is really funny because I think by regulations and by normal standards, it would be considered an environment in which would be substandard housing. But because of the organizational structure of the fact that we all want to be there and we're all productive members of that household, it's actually the most rich, incredibly beautiful living situation I've ever encountered.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a way for people to be able to restructure how they live and what they consider to be the most efficient way to live. And so rather than everyone kind of fighting for their individual self, if you can become part of a larger community and really help each other out and use that teamwork, so much can get accomplished.
So that's what you see happening in Venice, where you live?
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, the community network in Venice is really deep, and it just continues to grow. Every day when I go back and I meet a new neighbor, I feel like I'm a little less alone in Los Angeles. And especially when it comes to dealing with housing issues. If someone needs a spot to stay, by all means, you know, I don't mind taking them in, really helping them out, doing what I can. And so I think on a larger level, I see more of that all the time. When people are unemployed and they come out here to volunteer at Habitat, that's an example of how people are really starting to bridge those gaps. And like, while financially they might not be coming as successful, I think that there's a lot more fulfillment. There's a lot more interaction with people around. It's really, really nice to see.
One last thing we want to cover. Housing the homeless, it's one thing to put someone in a room with four walls, give them a key and a door. But a large majority of us homeless, and I include myself, we have our mental health issues, and to take us off the street and expect us to make a healthy transition without still carrying that which we lived with on the streets is very hard for us. So what do you think about the mental health services here in the greater Los Angeles area as it pertains to homelessness?
I'm not very familiar with the services that are offered, so it's hard for me to comment, but I was in Portland, Oregon a while ago.
Okay.
And in Portland, they have a area that's been designated for homeless people and is run exclusively by homeless people. And it's known as Dignity Village. And in Dignity Village, I went there and I visited the place and I saw it. And what they've done with the city gave them a parking lot and they've turned it into the most beautiful village. And there's so much responsibility there. Like, people have so much pride for what they have as homeless individuals with really no specific financial equity involved in the project. It's incredible. And so I think with those homeless issues, with the mental health issues, it is very important to acknowledge them and to really use those models of helping someone out, rehabilitating them. I'm someone who's very involved in health and more from a natural standpoint of looking at people's diets. I think that when you talk about cultivating your own food to eliminate a lot of the pesticides, a lot of the GMO type of things that we find in everyone's diet, that can really help people from a mental point of view as well. And so there's ways that as a community we can deal with those things as well. It's just a matter of being supportive, not giving up, and just continuing to just move forward in a way that, you know, no one left behind. So
okay. Well, great, Brett. Thank you very much for your time today. And we'll be in touch.
Right.
Our thanks goes out to Habitat for Humanity for the good work that they do. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Earlene Anthony for our community camera.
This is the community calendar for the month of October. Friday, October 14th through Sunday, October 16th at 4:30 and 6:30 various times. Nate Holden's Performing Arts Center presents Ebony Repertory Theater, Back to the Future in Search of a New Black Aesthetic. Again, this is at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center, location 4718 West Washington Boulevard. For more information on this event, you can contact ghookseboneyrep.org. Sunday, October the 23rd, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Drama Stage Coonrun presents a forum on homeless veterans in Los Angeles. The panel will be made up of veterans, religious, and community leaders, discussing topics on outreach, education, treatment, and prevention, housing, support services, income, employment benefits, community partnership, and much more. Location, The Exchange, 114 West 5th Street. This is a free event. Refreshments will be served. and we will pass out hygiene kits. For more information on this event, you can call 323-850-4436. This is a special announcement. Wednesday, October the 26th, beginning at 9 a.m., Long Beach Community Councilman D. Andrews presents a Peace and Justice Summit focusing on deciding how to assist with policy change and the reentry process, housing, employment, and much more. Child care and lunch will be provided. The location is at the Long Beach Convention Center, 300 East Ocean Boulevard in Long Beach. And for more information on this event, you can call 323-357-8431. And this is just a reminder, if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Early and Anthony. And once again, our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. I'm delighted to have with us in the studio tonight two very talented musicians, Jack Rivera and Steve Garza. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Hey. Hello. Thanks for having us, Mel.
Look, Jack, I want to start with you and Steve. Look, tell us quickly a little about yourself and how you developed your art form.
I started playing when I was a real young kid. I started playing drums when I was a little baby because, you know, I was born in 1964, and that's when the Beatles was happening, and my brother was all into that, so I was playing music since I was, you know, a little baby there. And just been doing it my whole life. Steve, I kind of grew up with here. He's from Ball Heights, East Side, and we grew up together in high school and all that kind of stuff.
We really liked the same music when we were teenagers and we found ourselves playing together.
Mm-hmm. Were you one of the berry pickers, too?
No, I wasn't one of the berry pickers, but the Jack and I used to play together
when we
were kids.
Yeah.
Here's
yeah.
the roadie.
Okay.
I was a hanger-on.
Now, how about some of your favorite musicians that influence you?
Well, like you were playing John Lee Hooker earlier. We were talking about on the lift on the way up. You know, guys like John Lee Hooker and Chuck Berry and Jimmy Reed.
Songs we learned, Boom Boom.
Mm-hmm. Stuff like that, a lot of blues people. We got into punk rock when we was kids.
Mm-hmm.
So bands like the Ramones and all that stuff, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty well-rounded. We like it all, you know.
We like country music as well.
We like country.
Oh,
like,
you know. Yeah. Do both of you write music?
I don't write. Jack does. So he does mm-hmm. some terrific songs.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know we'll be hearing from you and the voices from the Ether section in just a few minutes. But, Jack, for those who want to get in touch with you about performing, what is your contact information?
I have a Facebook page, which works pretty well for that sort of thing. It's just Jack Rivera at Facebook. I don't know exactly how the address thing works, but I'm, you know, pretty much the whole planet's on that thing now. So, mm-hmm. And I come up pretty quick. There'll always be a picture of a guitar or something.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Now, you also, tell us, I mentioned about the Berry Pickers.
Sure. And,
tell us a little about.
Yeah, the Berry Pickers was a cool band that I had when I was a kid. You know, it was my first band that I put together properly. That was right after I came out of band. I came out of a band called the Crawdaddies, which were real popular and real good, real influential. I was lucky enough to play with those guys. Came out of that and formed my own band, and that was the Berry Pickers. And it's just very 60s garage R&B kind of stuff. Very cool. It seems to be more popular now than it was back in its day.
Mm-hmm.
For us, just, anyway, so that's okay.
You just put them up on YouTube.
Yeah, huh? There's all kinds of stuff coming out. That's been my project. I've been blessed to play with a lot of neat, special people.
Who are the other members of the Berry Pickers? Did
well,
I
there was this guy.
Picture?
Yeah, well, it was John Vetter on bass. I think he's in film now. And the guy, the singer, went out to form a successful band called the Groovy Ghoulies, and his name is Jeff Alexander. He goes by the name of Kepi. But he does real good. And so they went off to do stuff, and you know, we all did. But like I was saying, I'm trying to document all this stuff. A lot of groups I've been with, you know, trying to get the music up and out and photographs and the whole bit. So, you know, mm-hmm. and that's a chore, man.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be busy for the rest of the year.
Yeah, so what have you been doing lately, Steve? as far as music is concerned?
You know, I really just picked music up again in the last 12 months or so, the last year. I kind of took a hiatus when I was about 20 and went back to college, and I had a successful career in the financial industry, of all things. And now I find myself kind of wanting to go back to my roots, you know. Mm-hmm. And once I started playing again, I started taking a few classes just to get back into it. And right away, I wanted to contact Jack again because he's one of the people that I grew up playing with. And we still love the same kinds of music. And we still have a little bit of chemistry going on, too, mm-hmm. when we get together, because we've known each other for so long. And, you know, okay. we have all the same influence.
Great, great. Okay, great. Now we're going to... at this time, we're going to move into our voices from the ether section, which is the last section that we have today. I have with us on the phone, in a minute, we'll be moving into our voices from the ether section. And what are the two songs that you're going to play for us when we get off into that section?
We'll see how the first one goes here. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to do some Jimmy Reed. We'll probably do Take Out Some Insurance, maybe Shame, 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 or maybe a Chuck Berry song, 30 mm-hmm. Days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it's sounding in here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, our last section for today is from our Voices from the Ether portion of the show. And I hope to have with us on the phone, Ty. Ty.
Yeah, Tyrone's got to answer his phone.
Okay, let's.
Hi, this is Eric. I'm not
Eric. Wrong number.
Okay. We wait as we waiting on Ty and our Voices from the Ether section. Let's move into our first song. And Jack, what's the name of the song?
This one's called Take Out Some Insurance. It's by the late great Jimmy Reed out of Chicago. One of my favorites. Ready? Some insurance on the way. Take out some insurance on the way. 'Cause if you ever say goodbye, I wanna right off and die. Show on my face. 'Cause
All right.
As long as it's not Kaiser, baby. As long as it's not Kaiser.
Now, Jack, tell us a little about the history of blues. How did blues develop in this country?
You're trying to get on the spot, my man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's
a three-hour show.
Tell us about some of the early blues musician that you know about.
You know, the way I understand it, I mean, you're really giving it to me now, buddy. You know, it comes, you know, from the old slavery days. You had what they would call, like, in the fields, you know, they'd do a lot of singing in the fields and stuff like that. I think the guys got a hold of guitars. I can tell you how they started playing slide on the guitars. Apparently, they would get bone and lay it against the strings and kind of make that crazy wailing sound, and that's how... Mm-hmm. Apparently that started, but out of there, and also jazz too, New Orleans. So that, you know,
who are some of the the blues musicians that started incorporating the harmonica into their playing?
The Chicago guys really did it. I mean, you know, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, those the folky kind of guys. But I think it really broke open when all the Southern blacks went up to Chicago, went up north for all the good jobs and stuff, and they started working and they needed music. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those guys from Mississippi, Muddy Waters, all those guys, right? But they'd go up to Chicago and they became Northerners. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Okay. Let's do another one. What's the next one you're going to do?
I don't know yet. Yeah. Let's do 30 days. So we do 30 days? We got one more, too.
Well, go ahead.
We're going to try to do this one here. This is an old song called 30 Days by my man, my pop, Chuck Berry. We're going to try to do this one here. Ready?
Jack, that's excellent. Chuck, what's that called? 30 days?
30 days, man.
Yeah.
Of all things.
Okay. You seem to be influenced a lot by Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
When you guys was young, you said the Berry Pickers.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Chuck Berry, we were big Chuck Berry fans. You know, there'd be no Rolling Stones, Mel, quite honestly. Pretty much no Beatles the way we know them if it wasn't for Chuck Berry. you know, John Lennon says it best, I guess, when he said, if you had to give rock and roll a different name, you'd call it Chuck Berry. You know, he's the guy. He's my guy anyway. And he's a fantastic showman, fantastic songwriter, incredible guitar player. A good-looking guy, too, you know.
You know, Chuck Berry,
the whole nine yards, you know.
Yeah.
Great guy. If I can interject for a minute, Chuck Berry's actually one of the big musicians who actually crossed over from having a primarily African-American audience to having both African-American and white audience. Mm-hmm. He brought rock and roll to the forefront.
People thought he was white when they first heard Maybelline on the radio.
Yeah.
People thought it was because it sounds country.
You
probably remember that. You're probably a little kid playing cowboy or something.
Yeah. Okay, do we have Ty on the line? Do we have Ty on the line?
Huh? Is Ty back there?
Tyrone, are you on the line? I guess he dropped.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Let's get back into our discussion of Chuck Berry. You were saying that he was one of the first that moved in the direction of crossover music?
Yeah, like Steve brought up, that's a good point. Most people thought he was white when they heard Maybelline. That's his first one, you know, oh, Maybelline, you know, why can't you be true? You know, he really has that kind of country thing to it. He's a very special guy, and what was great about him also, he was on Chess Records, which was primarily a blues label. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody was on that. John Lee Hooker, Howlin' Wolf, Bo Diddley, and Lil Walter, Sonny Boy Williamson. I mean, ridiculous amount of people they had on that label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and Chuck was there, you know, so there you go. Same band when they would record a lot of times, mix and match musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jack, tell us some of the things that you would be doing in the future. Are you forming your own band? What's happening with that?
You know, it's rough, man. It's real rough to do that. But obviously, getting back in the studio and doing recording, because I write, and I write for myself. And, you know, I'm an artist that way, so I like to play and just write for myself. I don't care if it's, you know, just in a bar or something. It's just having a good time. That's what I do. But there'll be recording and writing. I'm just got me a new place out in Silver Lake, so I'm going to be moving, and I got to deal with that. But, yeah, I've got Steve backing me up here, helping me out.
Mm-hmm.
So
now,
I'm in good shape.
How about some of the earlier members of the Berry Pickers? Are they still musicians?
Oh, as far as I know, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, as far as I know.
Okay,
yeah,
but you're not playing with any of those guys anymore at the time.
No, but what the first band I came on the scene with was a band called The Stains. And Stains is pretty much the first punk band that ever come out of the east side of Los Angeles. And there's going to be a reissue of an album. That band's managed to have a lot of longevity again.
Who was some of the guys that was in that?
That was Robert Becerra, Cesar Vescara, and Rudy Navarro. Great guys, all of them. We were playing around last year, did some reunion shows, and we'll probably do some more. And don't know who's going to re-release the album, but it's definitely going to come out. It's out there. We're getting offers, and we're starting to talk. We just got our masters back from one of these guys, and so now we got to get it out. And it's kind of funny that I'm spending a lot of time on all this past stuff, but that's what seems to be on the plate right now, and it is important. So.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to be getting all that stuff out, so there you are.
Okay, Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mel. We really enjoyed the music. We're going to be following you guys closely. You sound great. I would like to thank our in-studio guest, Ms. Kimberly J. Lewis, founder of Gene Kim Media, musician Jack Rivera and Steve Garza, and a special thanks to Jeremy and the Skid Row Studios. Our next show will deal with homeless veterans and the upcoming veteran forum at the Exchange on Sunday, October the 23rd, 2011, at 4 o'clock p.m. The Exchange is located at 114 West 5th Street. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report, and I leave you with the song that opened the show, Boom, 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 by Johnny Lee Hooker.
Feel better, Jacqueline.
boom, 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 boom. I'm gonna shoot you right down, right off of your feet. Take you home with me, put you in my house. Boom, 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 boom. How, 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 how. Love to see you strut up and down the floor when you're talking to me. That baby talk, I like it like that. Oh, yeah. Walk that walk, walk that walk. Walk that walk and talk that talk and whisper in my ear. Tell me that you love me. I love that talk. When you talk like that, you knock me out right off of my feet. Whoa, 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 whoa. Oh, talk.